Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is Perek Daled, chapter 4 of the book of Hosea, a chapter in which, for all that Hosea is complaining about issues that apply to his generation, many of them will be easily applicable to our times, or to at least some of the people in our times. So, Pasuk Aleph, Shimud Var Hashem Bnei Yisrael, Kiriv LaHashem Yoshvi Haaretz, Ki Ein Emet Ve'Ein Chesed, Ve'Ein Da'at Elokim Ba'aretz. So he says, hear the words of Hashem, O Jews, that Hashem has an argument to, a bone to pick, as it were, an argument with the inhabitants of the land, because there is no truth, and there is no kindness, and there is no da'at Elohim, there is no knowledge of God in the land. So Rashi lets this pasuk sort of stand. It seems sort of self-explanatory. There's no truth, there's no kindness, and there's no da'at Elohim. Radak has several comments that are striking. First one is, Riv im yoshvi haaretz, the Radak says, Ki bitinai natati lehem et haaretz. The land was given to the Jewish people on a certain condition. We'll get to the conditions in a second, but with conditions. And it's a land that I have claimed, Hashem has said, that he pays attention to all the time. That's pasuk of the Torah. And so if the Jews are going to do opposite to the condition, then Hashem will do opposite to the punishment, to the promises that Hashem made, and will remove his providence from us, and then the land, all the punishments, some of the punishments we're going to see in this parak, will come true in terms of exile and desolation, etc. So that's one set of points that I think are vital, that get lost in our consciousness, that what we have is given to us in condition, and that we sort of think, well, we're kind of good, and why shouldn't we get all this? But the Rather Radak is pointing out is that it depends on whether we're fulfilling that condition. So the condition, as the Radak notes, the condition at hand is that we are supposed to be doing tzedakah u'mishpat, righteousness and justice. And that's the condition. And the reason that's the condition is interesting, because the Pasuk says, ein emet ve'ein chesed. Right? We don't do emet, we don't do truth. Now that's something that I think is very applicable in our times. I find in my own life, perhaps I meet the wrong class of people, but I don't think so, that the dedication to truth, in its simplest form, to just being truthful, saying the truth, and acknowledging the truth, and being aware of the truth, is extremely deficient in our times. It doesn't exist. It doesn't, as an ideal, it almost doesn't exist. You know, I don't have time to tell stories about this, but I have many stories of people who are clear that they don't feel the need to be truthful. People who are rabbis, people who are dedicated public servants, who see themselves as pillars of the community. And yet the question of whether truth has to be an absolute in terms of, you have to tell the truth, you have to be truthful, so that's something that's very weak. But that's not even the point that I wanted to make. The Radak then says, when it says ein chesed, there's no kindness, he says, kol shekein she'ein chesed. All the more so that there can't be chesed. Then he says, ki chesed hu yitron atova. Chesed is an excess of good. If you're not doing the truth already, kol shekein she'lo yaseh chesed. It's all the more so that a person won't do chesed. So it could be the Radak means it's all the more so as a prediction, the likelihood is that there won't be chesed. And if that's true, then if you happen to live in a generation where people are doing chesed even though they're not truthful, even though they ignore truth, so that might be just be a remarkable, not aberration, but a remarkable change, and want to be applauded, that people who, even people who aren't truthful, still do manage to do chesed. But I'm not sure that it could, it seems to be possible at least, the Radak could mean that it's not plausible to do chesed, because unless you know what the truth is and what you know what the bottom line of what should happen is, then you can't know what chesed is, and things that you think of as chesed are really not chesed. So that's a more complicated topic as to what is or doesn't, does or doesn't count as chesed, but I think that it comes up here. So is it helpful to help somebody across the street? So if they're an old person who's innocent and who has nothing else going wrong, then yes. But if they're running to murder somebody, or they're interested in murdering somebody, then no. So obviously that's an extreme example, and I don't think that happens often, but I think that question is one interesting that comes out of here. And then the last part of the last phrase, the Radak says, Vein Dat Elokim Ba'aretz, there is no knowledge of God, he says, two options. La'asot Mishpat Tzedakah, in which case, Ein Chesed Vein Emet Vein Chesed, are the lead into the fact that there's no da'at Elohim, there's no knowledge of God. And then that would mean, and then there are plenty of psukim that can support this kind of a view, it would mean that the appropriate and the clear application of justice, and then also of kindness or righteousness, or beyond the Kli Mishurat Adin, is an act of coming to know God. But then if you do it wrong, you're losing your knowledge of God. So it's not a question of you get to do justice the way you think justice is right. It's a question of applying your intuition and your rationality to justice. It's a question of finding the way to the form of justice that in fact is knowledge of God. And the other possibility is the more prosaic one, the more simple one, that we don't have in his time. And Hoshea is complaining, Hashem is complaining, that there's no chakira b'yidat elokuto. There's nobody looking around to see what Hashem is doing. In terms of pshat and the psukim, I think that the first pshat is more, fits in better. It's more of a stretch or more of a chiddush, more of a novelty to say that our failure to do tzedakah mishpat is in fact in and of itself a sign there won't be any knowledge of God. But that's what I think the Radak is suggesting. So pasuk bet alo v'chachesh v'ratzoch v'ganov v'na'of paratzu v'damim v'damim nagao. So now we see that why there's no truth in kindness. So alo v'chachesh is that people are taking oaths. They're taking oaths and they're not keeping them. So Rashi says, they swear falsely, and then they murder, and then they steal, and then they fornicate, they commit adultery. Paratsu, Rashi says, Rashi quotes Targum Yonatan, that they produce children from the wives of their friends. So it's not just they commit adultery, but they actually have adult children from these adulterous affairs, mamzerim. V'damim v'damim nagao, and then, so Rashi says the simplest meaning is, damim doesn't necessarily mean literally blood, it means just guilt. Guilt attaches to guilt, they go from one sin to the other sin. Or the other possibility is that they actually kill so many people that the blood of one victim meets up with the blood of another victim. Usually if you have a victim in an ordinary society, a murder is a shocking thing, doesn't happen so often, and so the blood of that victim will be cleaned up and won't just run free. But if there's tremendous amounts of blood, then the bloods will run into each other, and that might be what's being referred to here. So that would be Alova Chesh Damim Damim Nagao. Damim Damim Nagao was also taken in the Gemara in Gittin, the well-known Gemara that talks about the Chorban. So it talks about Nebuzaradan coming and seeing the blood of Zechariah. Zechariah was a Navi who tried to get the Jewish people to stop doing various of their sins, and they killed him in the Beit HaMikdash. And so the tradition is that his blood continued to run until the Chorban, until the bite was destroyed, until the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. And that when Nebuzaradan came, he decided to take it upon himself to get that blood to stop, and so he started killing many, many, many Jews, and in the course of killing all these Jews, the bloods ran into each other, ran into the blood of Zechariah, and nothing happened. That's Damim B'damim Nagao. So that if you read the pasuk that way, as the Gemara does, it would mean that Hashem will bring a situation whereby the blood of all the victims will run into the blood of other victims, and that'll be part of the punishment that's going on. The Gemara in Shavuot on Daf Lamed Tet points out that when people were obligated to produce a Shavuah De'oraita, when they were required to make an oath that the Torah demanded of the oath, so it was taken very, very seriously. We in our day, I think, I could be wrong, but we in our day seem to take, and this is part of the theme of the Perek, seem to take falsehood not so seriously. So let's say, for example, and I have asked this is a political question to some extent, but if somebody in a position of authority, like a president, were to lie under oath. So I think, I know from experience, from having watched it happen, that there are people in this country who say, well, it's not such a big deal. And that's not worthy of making a huge fuss about. So that might be, so the fact that I react differently could be that I have personal political views that are different than that. But what the Perek, I think, is saying is that that's not true, that the alo v'chachesh, the falsehood and the lack of respect for truth, is in fact a thing that will lead into then murder and theft and a lack of concern with monetary sanctity, with the sanctity of other people's money. That's something we see in America today with all of the various fraud investigations that are going on and all of the greed of the 1990s and the first decade of the 2000s that then lead to some people going too far and then a lot of other people losing a lot of money because people cheat and they steal and they lie all in the pursuit of the money, and it all comes from their lack of a dedication to truth. In that context, taking an oath, D'oraita, is a hugely important and a hugely significant event, and it was supposed to be taken very seriously. The Mishnah, in one of the first Mishnahs that many, many young Jews learn, is in Hamafkid, where the Mishnah points out there were people who, even though they were free of any guilt, and they had the right by virtue of Torah law to just take an oath and avoid having to make a monetary payment, there were people whose practice it was to make the monetary payment rather than take the oath, because they didn't want to get into oaths, they didn't want to get involved in that area of life because they were very nervous with taking false oaths. So in that, all of that is background. The Mishnah in Shavuot, when it's talking about taking an oath, D'oraita, says how they used to bring the guy into a dark room with dark candle, with, and they light a few candles, it would be all dark, and they were trying to make him afraid of this oath and let him know that unless he's telling the truth, it's a very serious thing. And they would quote this pasuk among others, "Alo v'chachesh," and they would point out pasuk Gimel, "Lakein te'eval ha'aretz v'umlal kol yoshev bach v'chayat hasadeh v'ofa shemayim v'gam digayam yi'aseifu." Therefore, the land will be in mourning, meaning desolate. There won't be, there will be a lot of mourning in it, and there won't be a lot of people, or the umlal kol yoshev bach, everything that's in it is going to be like an umla, like all alone and have no support. And the chayat hasadeh, the animals of the field and the birds of the sky and even the fish of the sea will be removed from there. So that is a whole discussion about whether chayat hasadeh means the domesticated animals. What it means is when people leave, so also there won't be cows or horses. Then it's just, no, it might even mean that it might even mean that even wild animals will not. The land will become completely desolate because when there are no people around, so there's no support system, and maybe even that, and so too with the birds of the sky. That by and large, he says, by and large, birds don't live in desert and in places that aren't having no habitation whatsoever. They live near places where there's some kind of habitation, and the land will become completely completely desolate. And he quotes a medrash, he quotes a Mamar Chazal, that Yehuda said that Behema in Gematria is 52, and that there were 52 years where the land of Israel really was completely empty, completely devoid of people. Ach, pasuk dalet, ach, ish al yarev v'ayochach, ish v'amecha kim rivei kohen. So, ach, ish al yarev is taken to be what the Jewish people, taken by Rashi to be what the Jewish people say. And that's the way the JPS English translated also is they're saying, you say when there's a Navi who comes try to tell you the truth and try to tell you what you should do to improve your situation, you say, don't give Nevuah, we don't want to hear it. And then Ve'amech and Rivei Kohen, that they also fight with the Kohanim to stop them, because the Kohanim's job, they weren't Nevi'im, but their job was to teach the people Torah. So when they would try to come and teach the people Torah, not only, as Radak points out, not only didn't they accept it, right, so that's one area. Right? If, as a parent, you might know this situation where you tell a kid what they're supposed to do, right? And they don't listen. They don't do it. They don't change. So that's one level of disobedience. But the next level was they actually reject it and they object to it and they say, don't tell us this. And that's also what's going on with Merivei Kohen. Now, there are many ma'amarim about Merivei Kohen, whether the Kohanim might have been litigious or might have been people who fought a lot with each other because they were used to giving rebuke. That's a discussion we can't get into now, but here in our context, the pasuk seems to mean that Hosea is pointing out B'Shem Hashem to the people that they have Nevi'im who come to them, and they have Kohanim who try to teach them the truth, and they not only reject it and refuse to listen, that would be one level, but they even stop them from performing their task and from trying to give their admonishment, trying to give their ability to show people the right way. Now we have in that situation, and I don't think that's a situation that's unrelated to today, because I once upon a time was a rabbi in a shul, and I had some similar experiences with the question of what do people in the shul willing to listen, willing to have you say to them in terms of how they might want to try to rectify their behavior, rectify their conduct. So one situation would be if they think that what you're trying to tell them to do is not what the right thing should be to do, and then you have a whole complication because maybe they're right, maybe you're wrong, and you're picking a point that's not their issue. But it certainly also happens where you're raising a point, they say, yeah, that's actually a true, valid Jewish point. We don't want to hear it. Don't tell it to us. We're not interested. We're not interested in making this point now. We'd like you to stop doing this, and if you continue doing this, we're going to have to think about going our own way in terms of employment and in terms of you being a functioning rabbi in our context. So that's similar, I think, it seems to me, very similar to what you have here, and this is what Hosea is complaining about. The people who have come to try to show them the right way, the people say to them, we don't want to hear from you. So the reaction or the punishment for this is that you're going to get punished and you're going to stumble in your way. You're not going to be able to have the success that you wanted to have, that you expected to have. You're going to be punished. And then Rashi thinks that the Nevi'im will be the Nevi'ei Sheker. And they're part of the problem because they are part of what gives the people the sense of comfort in rejecting the Nevi'ei Emet, right? The true prophets come to tell them what they're supposed to be doing. but there are competitor prophets. There are other prophets out there saying, no, no, you don't have to do that, you can do this, and it's just as good. And the people don't know what to follow, or they choose to follow the Nevi'ei Sheker because it's more comfortable following the false prophets, because they ratify what the people are doing. So it's always easier. If somebody says to you, oh, you're great, you certainly like that guy better. So if one guy says, you're great, and another guy says, you're doing the wrong thing, and the Torah doesn't want you to do that, your tendency will be, the human tendency will be, to follow the guy who says, you're great. So that's part of what's going on here, and that's part of what Hosea is pointing out to the people is a significant problem here, and is going to lead to their downfall, along with the Nevi'ei Sheker's downfall. V'damiti imecha. So we've seen before the word imecha, your mother, to refer to the Jewish people as a nation, and Hashem is saying that the nation as a nation, or at least according to the Radak, the nation as a nation will be destroyed because they're going to be scattered throughout the exile, and they won't be a nation anymore. And this is something, in terms of the punishment of exile, to be aware of, right? Even though Jews always had a connection to each other, it's also true, we just know this from the development of Sephardi custom as opposed to Ashkenazi custom, from Eastern European customs as opposed to Western European customs. We know that the Jewish people as a people throughout Galut lost much of their cohesion. And now, as many of them gather into Eretz Israel, the question of how to return or come back to being a full nation which is unified and which shares a sense of what it means to be Jewish and of the central practices and of following them together and of doing them together, that's a challenge that we continue to face in our times, I think at least partially, as a result, as a continuing dividend is not the right word, as a continuing result, as a continuing consequence of the Galut that we still have to pay attention to. And that's what Damiti Imecha means. This is a long parak and it's a very rich one, but I would just point out, just as a thing to think about, that there is a Gemara in which, there are a couple of Gemaras in which Reish Lakish is of the opinion, Reish Lakish is of the opinion in, it's a Gemara in Menachot and a Gemara in Moed Katan, Reish Lakish's opinion that if you ever have to discipline a Talmid Chacham, a scholar who has gone on the wrong in the wrong direction and has done wrong things, so you discipline him at night, you discipline him in private. And there's some discussion about whether that's only the first time. Reish Lakish seems to hold that it's all the way throughout. That there's a that if a, and the other opinion was that no, you discipline him in public after one time. The first time you do it in private, after one time you discipline him in public because of the Chilul Hashem involved, because people will see him doing the wrong thing and it'll be a Chilul Hashem. And Reish Lakish seems to be of the opinion that nonetheless you should continue doing it in private by virtue of the fact that this person is a Torah scholar and has learned a lot of Torah, so he has certain rights in terms of how it is that you discipline him. That's a tense and a sensitive topic in our days, and one of them I think is worth considering. So there are two opinions in the Gemara. You might say, well, I follow the other opinion, but certainly one worth hashing through at some other occasion. So, Nidmu Ami means they're going to be destroyed, they're going to be punished, and they're going to be cut off from the land, and they're going to do it because, and what's going to lead to it is, there's no da'at among them. There's no knowledge of God. They don't even have the way to know what they should have been doing. And the reason why they won't have the way of knowing what to be doing is because they've rejected the Nevi'ei Hemet. They've told them to go off and not to give them their rebuke. And they said it to the Kohanim as well. And so they don't have anybody who can tell them what they're doing. Right? And it'll be, in that time, they won't even have any more Nevi'ei Emet, I think. This is a promise that they're going to lose them. Because until now, the Nevi'im have been coming day after day, is where the Radak has it, and the Kohanim either were doing it according to Rashi, or stopped doing it at some point, and then they also stray along with the people, and you forget the Torah that Hashem gave you, and that's going to be the downfall. So a huge piece of this is, the loss of Torah leads to the loss of the ability to serve Hashem in the right way. Kirubam kin chatu li, Kivodam Bikalon Amir. So they, Kirubam, they really, most of them, the vast majority of them, turned away Hashem from Hashem. So therefore Hashem is going to turn away from them, and they're going to lose their honor and their respect among the nations, meaning they'll stop having any kind of power. Rashi thinks Kirubam means Kishe Rabu Vigadlu, Kinosifu Lachto. The more powerful, the better they got, the more success they had, the more they would sin. and the more the Nevi'im would come and try to admonish them, the more they'd run away from them. And that's what it'd be. So that comes back to that old paradox that we've seen a bunch of times, in which getting good only leads them to be worse, and that would be the way Rashi's understanding it. But in any case, it means that they've left Torah, they've left the acceptance of the discipline of those who would teach them Torah and teach them the right way to act, and they turn towards those who are teaching them wrong things, and perhaps not even clear who wasn't even clear. It's not necessarily true that they did it on purpose. They may have not been able to tell the difference between them, so that's a problem in and of itself, and therefore they're going to get the punishment. The sins of the people are going to eat them up, meaning because of their various sins, they're going to get their punishment, and then they'll turn their souls towards these Nevi'im. So this part of it at least is seen, perhaps the first part of the puzzle as well, I've seen it being about the Kohanim, that the Kohanim, who have stopped giving the proper rebuke and have not done the right thing, so now they are actually enjoying the sins of the people. And why do they enjoy the sins of the people? Because when people sin, Rashi says, when people sin, and the Ritak also says, they bring korbanot to get kapara, they bring korbanot to get atonement, and then the Kohanim get meat. So there is, in what we might call a conflict of interest to a certain extent, while it's the Kohanim's job to help the people avoid sin, they have a financial stake and a dietetic stake in having the people sin, because then they bring the meat, and then they get to eat meat of Kodesh. And that conflict of interest becomes a significant problem here in this pasuk. Pasuk tet vayach ha'am ka'kohen ufkati alav derechav umal alav ashiv lo. So Hashem says, and because of all this, it turns out that the people and the Kohanim are sort of partners in this sin, because the people are committing the sin because they enjoy it, and the Kohanim are allowing it or not fighting it or kind of excited about it because it makes more business for them, and business is good. So because of that, they also will get punished together, and Hashem will compensate them in a kind or in appropriate ways for what they've done wrong. They'll eat and not be satisfied. He's nuvelo yifrotzu, and they will, commit adultery. They will commit sexual sins, and yet they won't have children. Earlier in the paragraph, we said they've already been producing children from their inappropriate activities. That's one kind of a problem, because then we're saying that they're producing mamzerim, but here the point is going to be they're going to eat and not be satisfied. They're going to have all sorts of sexuality and yet not have children. Or if they have children, those children will die. So the ability to reproduce will be significantly cut down because they left Hashem. They left Hashem from watching Hashem. Let me pause here in the middle of the parak for a second to point out that as Hoshea and other Nevi'im complain about the people, I made this point before, but I think it's always important to keep it in mind and to keep it in perspective. When Hoshea complains about the people and tells them what's going to happen to them and what the problems are going to be and who's committed the sin, you have to always ask yourself, what percentages is he talking about? Because that affects our understanding of what he's promising as well. Does Hoshea mean that 99% of the Jewish people have committed the very sins that we're talking about here? It's a possibility, right? But is it necessarily what he means to imply? Because if it's not, and this is why I raise the point, if it's not, then the promise of punishment presumably also doesn't apply to the 99%. So even if it's only 70%, or 60, right? 66 and two-thirds is a two-thirds majority. We think of that as a huge majority. It's a super majority in American conversations about laws and making laws and things like that. So let's say it's only, and only I put in quotes, it's only a supermajority of the Jewish people. It's 70% of the Jewish people committing certain sins. So that certainly would seem worthy of complaint by a Navi. But then the punishment would presumably only reach that 70% as well, by and large, unless you want to say that even those who haven't sinned bear some culpability by virtue of not having given effective rebuke, and then you have to all talk about the percentages. So, could be. So let's say, let's say 60% are giving the actual, are committing the actual sins, and 10% or 20% are not giving the rebuke the way they should. That's a huge number. It doesn't seem to me like a reasonable number, because it wasn't 20% of the society that was supposed to be giving the rebuke. So let's say 60% are committing the sins, huge number. 20% are not giving the rebuke as they should. still means that there are 20% that are fine, and that 20% presumably will not get significant punishment. Now, that's a very small percentage, right? We think of the Holocaust, rightfully, as a terrible, unbelievable tragedy for the Jewish people. And it was that two-thirds, the best numbers seem to say, two-thirds of the European Jewish community was wiped out, and one-third of the world Jewish community was wiped out. Huge percentages, terrible tragedy, and leaving what feels like a tattered remnant behind, but it's in fact two-thirds of the Jewish people at the time still live. So I put that in perspective here. That means that when Hosea is promising certain punishments, if we think that in order for the punishment to be real, it would have to affect 80% of the Jewish people, it's not true. As soon as it affected 33%, a third of one of world Jewry, it would be a huge punishment, almost an unprecedented punishment, right? So that could be what Hashem is talking about, and yet it would leave a lot of room for people to look around and say, well, that happened to them, it didn't happen to us, and that's the whole Jewish people, it's not this, it's not that, to doubt, to this, to that. So all of that, I think, needs to be brought in here and remembered as we read psukim like this. Pasukit Aleph, Zinut, V'yayin, V'tirosh, Yikach Lev. We've spoken until now in this parak about the actions that they've been doing and the wrongs that they've been doing, but this pasuk now gives us the reason, as far as the Navi is concerned, the reason or the cause that led to all of these wrongs occurring, and it's because of physical desires and physical pleasures. They're interested in fornication, in wine, and in new wine. Tirosh, new wine, or tirosh is grain, but interested in physical pleasures and in eating and drinking and enjoying. So that is what takes your heart away from the study of Torah and from the involvement in Torah and an involvement in knowing what the right way is to act and to live. I think about this in the culture of the Western world because, as my teacher, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, pointed out in an article one time, there was a long time when the Jewish community was battling against overindulging in physical pleasures. But in our times, it's not a question only that we don't battle against overindulgence, or that we're not ascetics, we don't try to restrict our pleasures to such a minimal level that we can't imagine it. It's that we think it's fine to completely indulge. As long as, I think that if you spoke to many, many Jews today, they would say, as long as I've given the right amount of tzedakah and I've paid my dues to God, as it were, and I've given God whatever God could reasonably think of as appropriate for that, and if I have money left over, any money I have left over, I can do whatever I want with it, and I can just enjoy myself in various physical pleasures. And I think what the Navi is pointing out is that's the first step in losing sight of Hashem. So Ami Beitzo Yishal is taken by the Gemara Umaklo Yagidlo, is taken by the Gemara as being a mocking of those who know the answer they want to hear, and they're only willing to go and hear that answer that they were looking for. And that's a terrible thing, because you're supposed to be, when you look for the answers to Torah, you're supposed to be looking for what Hashem really wants. It's a Gemara in Pesachim. Right? So that you're supposed to be looking for the answers that are the true answers. So what the true answers are, if there's a machloket, that's a whole question. Right? Is the Mekel true, or is the Machmir true, and how do you know? That's a very difficult question, and the answers are not necessarily clear. But what is clear is that if you go into the question knowing the answer you're willing to accept and knowing the answer you're not willing to accept, so that's not a process of searching for Torah in its honest and true form, and that's Ami Beitzo Yishal Umaklo Yagid Lo, and it's a spirit of Zinunim, of turning away from Hashem, being led astray, and that's an example of turning away from Hashem. Pasuk Yud Gimel, Roshei Harim Yizabechu V'ala Gevot Yikateru Tachar Alon V'Livne Ve'ila Ki Tov Tzilach Halkein Tiznena Benotechem V'Chalotechem Tina'afna. Now we get from there, so it starts with loss of Torah, loss of interest in being rebuked, loss of interest in admonishment, loss of interest in finding the truth and knowing what the truth is. That's where it starts. But then it goes to, is what the pasuk is telling us, goes to actual idol worship. And on the high mountains and on the hills and under the flowering trees that have a lot of shade and therefore very beautiful, and that would lead people to want to worship there because of all of these reasons. That's where they're worshiping idols, and therefore their daughters commit fornicate, and aren't sexually appropriate, and your daughters-in-law also commit adultery. Now, the therefore, Rashi thinks that therefore comes, or Rashi suggests that therefore comes from the fact that they're not home, that there's no hashkacha, there's nobody watching over the home situation because they're busy off, they're off busily worshipping idols, and that that's what leads to the daughters and daughters-in-law having the freedom to commit the adultery that we're talking about here. So that's a possibility. The other possibility would be to read it as that once you have a society that turns away from Hashem, turns away from Torah, and turns away and gets involved in very much physical pleasures, which leads to idol worship, those same impulses are the ones that lead to a free sexuality. And that whole question of whether there's a connection between free sexuality and Avodah Zarah is one to pay careful attention to. I would argue, it seems to me from my understanding of Torah, that the Torah says resoundingly yes, that they are connected to each other. And that is why I think the Torah, well, that's one of the reasons why the Torah is so opposed and so sensitive to arayot and sexual immorality, because the two go together. The indulgence in physical pleasure and the belief that physical pleasure of any form is an end of its own and it just should be indulged freely is one that leads us away from Hashem, as the Pasuk said here, Zanut v'yayin v'tiro, shikach lev. Pasuk yudalad lo efkod al benotichem ki tiznenem al kolotichem ki tina afna ki heim im hazonot yifaredu v'makedeshot yizabechu ve'am lo yavin yilaveit. So Hashem says, and I'm not even going to punish them. These daughters-in-law are committing adultery and committing fornication and are violating all the norms of their society. I'm not going to punish them. Because Hashem says, because they got the idea from you. Because part of idol worship in those days, so it wasn't just idol worship, there's another aspect of it, part of idol worship in those days was a sexual element. So you people are off doing your things with zonot, you're involved in this with kideshot, and you're making sacrifice with them and eating meat with them and enjoying them, and then you expect, right, your daughters and daughters-in-law to be sexually appropriate. So Hashem says, not true. And this is our tradition also, is in terms of, in general, we have a sota situation in the Torah. So if a woman is a sota, meaning she had an inappropriate private instance with a man, not her husband, after he warned her not to, so the halacha is that if the husband has not been fully sexually appropriate, the sota waters won't check her. Not because her sin is less, but because it's not proper that she's going to be judged by this man when he himself is not fully appropriate, not fully within what the halacha was supposed to be. And that's what's going on here as well. And the Gemara actually says that after a certain point in Jewish history, may start to stop working. The Ramban says this is the only thing in Torah that relies on a miracle. The miracle is that you put this water inside of her and it makes her blow up. The Ramban says you don't get a miracle like that when you're not appropriate yourself. So there came a point in Jewish history where, since the society as a whole was just not behaving properly and appropriately, so Hashem took away the whole right of the sota waters to work, and that stopped functioning in the Jewish people. Pasuk Tet Vav, Im Zoneh Ata Yisrael Al Yashem Yehuda, Vatavoa Gilgal Vatalu Beit Avin Vatisha Ve'u Chai Hashem. So then Hosea points out that this is all true of the northern kingdom at this point that he's complaining about. And he warns the southern kingdom, Yehuda, not to get involved in this, not to go up there, and not to learn from them. That's a warning that doesn't eventually come true, because they do eventually learn from them. So he says, don't go up there and don't get involved in this. And then Al-Tishavu B'Shem Hashem is talking to the northern kingdom and saying, you've lost the right to swear in the name of Hashem. Rashi shockingly suggests or argues or has a tradition that says that they would swear in the name of God when they were telling lies, when they were lying. But when they were telling the truth, that's when they would swear in the name of the idol worship. So that's such an inversion of what their proper dedication was. The whole idea that we're supposed to swear b'shem Hashem is that Hashem is supposed to be our model of what truth is, and our function, and if I'm saying something b'shem Hashem, it should so obviously be true, because how could I even dare to lie b'shem Hashem? And I'm saying that got totally inverted in this northern kingdom in Yisrael, that they got so involved in their idol worship that became the standard of truth for them. And Hosea is calling out to Yehuda not to get involved in that. Pasuk Tet Zayin, Ki Kifaras Tov Riras Avar Yisrael Ata Yireim Hashem Kif Keves Bamerchav. So they became, Hosea is saying, like a paras avira. Paras avira is like an ox or a cow that you're trying to have pull a plow, and it insists on straying, so you can't dig a straight furrow with it. So that's an interesting metaphor, and therefore, the end of the metaphor is, therefore Hashem is going to have to pasture them like sheep, and Rashi says, in a very narrow, very restricted, very confined pasture. Right? If you have sheep who tend to wander off, then you have to make sure to pasture them only in a very narrow place where you can easily watch over them. So there's going to be a loss of freedom, a loss of perhaps, b'chirach of sheep, perhaps free will, but there's going to be a loss there. The metaphor is particularly interesting because if the cow would only understand what it was doing, obviously cows count and oxen can't, but they would know that digging a straight furrow is very important for them as well, because digging the straight furrow produces the grain, and the grain produces the wealth that gives this farmer the ability to feed the cows, so it's in the cow's best interests. It's not the cow's doing something for the farmer. The cow's doing something for its own best interest, because having a good harvest is good for everybody involved. So if I'm not sure that that's what Hoshea meant by the metaphor, but if that's what Hoshea meant by the metaphor, then it's very appropriate, because here too, the Jewish people are like a paras sarira, the northern kingdom. They refuse to follow what Hashem wants from them, even though it really is for their own good. And the response is to be Hashem has to restrict them. Chavur atzabim Ephraim anach lo. So Hashem says you're going to have to leave Ephraim alone. We're going to have to let them sort of fall further into their evil and get punished. That's what anach lo is. The anach lo is Hashem talking to the Navi saying, you can't just stop for a while. Don't. Don't, Rashi agrees, and don't try to stop them because they've gotten so addicted to their idol worship. There's just nothing we can do, and therefore you just have to leave them alone. Sars of Amas Nehis Nu Ahavu Hevu Kalon Mig Maginah. They drink a lot, and their liquor's gonna bother them, and then they love so much, they're all full of love, and they're going to become disgraced. It's gonna be the gift that all of these actions will give them. They're going to lead themselves into embarrassment and denigration and debasement and being debased. So, and but sometimes it's just what has to happen. They're so caught up in what they're doing, there's no way to get them out of it. This is, I think, also something that's easily applicable to our times, where you see that the interest in physical desires, the interest in doing what they want, often leads to situations where those, not Nevi'im, because I don't know the way of Nevi'im today, but those who would point out to others the proper way to live have no entry, have no way of getting in there, and the only strategy that can work is waiting, and eventually they fall so low and they fall so terribly that then perhaps they're ready to learn their lesson. Pasuk Yutet, Sara Ruach Otah Bichnafeha V'yevoshu Mizivchotam. The shame is going to eventually come. The wind is bringing it. It's coming. Sara Ruach, it's like you... So the Radak says it's like you try to capture the wind in your wings. If you have wings, you try to make something to capture the wind, and when you open it up, you find you have nothing there. So too, the Northern Kingdom is so strongly embedded and entrenched in its idol worship, and they're trying to get the spirit of the idols, but there is no such thing as spirit of the idols, that they're really ending up with nothing, and then all of their worship and all of their spirituality and all of their thinking that they were doing something amazing is going to lead them to eventually realize it was just like they had wind in their sails. They were trying to capture, not wind in their sails, they were trying to capture the wind, and it doesn't work to capture the wind, and they will have the embarrassment of seeing all of that. So this is the rebuke, this is the admonishment that Hoshea is trying to give, and as always, the reason for recording this is for people to read it in his time, in our time, and to draw the appropriate lessons so that hopefully we can avert having to be as involved in all of the punishments and all the desolation that was predicted, that we as a Jewish people already have gone through much of it, but that we can bring it to a close as speedily and quickly as possible. Have a great day.